knights and fair maidens, adventure and romance, triumph and tragedy, chivalry and villainy. These are the Middle Ages, and this is your gateway to the medieval world. Join Sir Justin and his guests as we step back in time and experience all things medieval, an exciting program dedicated to bringing you information, tales and knowledge on the Middle Ages from the past, the present and the future. Welcome, my lords and ladies. Thanks for tuning in, and thank you to all of our returning listeners, and welcome to those of you who may be listening for the first time. This is the All Things Medieval podcast, episode 3 for March 2008. I hope you're all in fine cheer and have had time for doing something related to the Middle Ages, be it entertainment, study or reenactment. I'd like to tell you a little bit about what I've been up to in my own personal medieval world, so to speak. As one of the few folks who are blessed to be able to turn a medieval pastime into a profession, I travel around performing as a 14th century knight and selling medieval reproductions, and February has been a very busy month for me. It has been horribly hot, however, being Australia, and it makes me respect the people who fought in the conflicts in the Middle East and the Mediterranean regions wearing 50 kgs, give or take, of armour. Some of my jobs this month have included some photography work for an artist, which hopefully I can speak more about in future episodes, some advertising promotions for a casting agency, and a birthday party for a 7-year-old lad. It's great to see such an interest in the Middle Ages. I love it. I've also been performing at the Abbey Museum of Art and Archaeology, entertaining tourist groups who come through to see the church, complete with 11th century stained glass and the museum's collection of antiquities, the largest collection in the southern hemisphere. It's novel to note that the older people, those who are 60 plus, are less knowledgeable about the facts than the younger generations. They ask or say things along the lines of, knights ride heavy draft horses, or swords and armour were extremely heavy, or that medieval people were all terribly short. It gives me cause to ponder and reflect. Are we finally educating our children correctly with things medieval? TV shows, movies, books and websites are all more accurate now than ever before. There are even toy figures available these days that are a pretty accurate rendition of a medieval knight. Now more than before, the general public can draw a distinction between the fantasy genre and the historical genre, even if and when they are unaware that they've done so. I've been performing and educating professionally for 4 years now, and the questions remain the same, although I must admit less frequent, and I've noticed that people, especially kids, are beginning to know more of truth than fiction regarding the Middle Ages. I'd like to think that we as performers, reenactors and amateur historians, or even just fans who know a little bit, have played some part in this. This month's episode has a bit of a theme throughout, and that theme is swords. In a new segment, we'll be talking about swords, and the marketplace will feature some reputable dealers of fine reproduction blades. And in our main feature, we'll be talking with the Hochmeister of the Marxbruder Historical Fight School, Mr. Matthew Hoffman. I'm considering having themed episodes each month, wherein the theme will take up 2/3 of each show, perhaps less, and some ideas I have in mind for themes are things like food and beverage, medicine, tournaments, specific conflicts or campaigns such as the Hundred Years' War, the Reconquista in Spain, I think I've said Reconquista correctly, or the Norman Conquest. Other themes, medieval women, the courts of nobility, arts and culture, etc., etc. I've not as yet entirely sold this idea to myself, but here is where you can help. Sell it to me, or convince me otherwise if you would like to see a theme in each episode. Email me at podcast@sirjustin.com if you have any thoughts on it. Also, if you have an idea for a feature or a theme, email it to me and I'll get it done. Even if I don't know a lot about the subject you request personally, I will most likely know someone who does, and we can get them on the show, and they can teach us all a thing or two of interest about the specific subject. Finally, before we get into the heart of the show, if you have any questions regarding the Middle Ages, send me an email. If you have a raging inquiry about something that happened in the Middle Ages, or about a person, place, item, occupation, a movie you've seen and can't recall, or you'd like an opinion on, same goes with a book, or anything related to the genre, or if you'd like to hear my take on something that you find interesting, send an email to podcast@sirjustin.com, or alternatively, jump on the forums at sirjustin.com. and let it be known there. If we get enough questions, I might just start a new question and answer segment on the show. Anyway, that's enough reflections and ponderings on my part, and we'll get straight into the show. Bringing you the latest happenings from across the kingdom, here comes the All Things Medieval Herald in the Herald's Call. Thank you, Herald. Straight off the scriptorium and still wet with ink, I have the news this month. Quite a bit of news to get through, so without any ado, without any mucking about, without any digressing or any rambling or wandering off or you know, just not doing what I'm meant to be doing, without any of that, we'll get straight into it. First story is regarding height in the Middle Ages. Men living during the early Middle Ages, that is the 9th to 11th centuries, were several centimetres taller than men who lived hundreds of years later on the eve of the Industrial Revolution, said Richard Steckel, a professor of economics at Ohio State University and the author of a new study that looks at changes in average heights during the last millennium. Height is an indicator of overall health and economic well-being, and learning that people were so well off 1,000 to 1,200 years ago was surprising, he said. Steckel analysed height data from thousands of skeletons excavated from burial sites in northern Europe and dating from the 9th to the 19th centuries. Average height declined slightly during the 12th through 16th centuries and hit an all-time low during the 17th and 18th centuries. Northern European men had lost an average 2.5 inches of height by the 1700s, a loss that was not fully recovered until the first half of the 20th century. Now that's very interesting, considering I get it all the time, people say, oh, but back in the Middle Ages, people were so small, they were tiny, weren't they? And it's a common myth, and I'm not entirely sure where that myth has come from. I've got a couple of thoughts on it, which if you'd bear with me, I'd like to share with you right now. A lot of the time, these same people, when you correct them and say, well, no, not really, the height wasn't too much... The average height wasn't too much different to today. It's not as a bigger contrast as one might think. And they'll say, oh, but I've seen these tiny suits of armour in the Tower of London which look like they were made for a child. Well, yes, that's because they were made for a child. Those small suits of armour that you see were made for children from rich aristocratic families in the Middle Ages. You can imagine if these children are being groomed and being trained for warfare and battle and such, it's going to be their full-time job should they turn out to be the child correct for the job. They're going to want to start training and practicing as soon as they can. So they made this armour, and it's so well preserved because a lot of the times they didn't just send the children straight off into battle wearing their armour. It wasn't sort of like, well, there you go, little Johnny. It's your 10th birthday, son, and I've got a surprise for you. The Battle of Agincourt. There's your horse. There's the English over there, and we just want you to charge in and do your best, son. Make me proud. I mean, it was something... obviously, children were present on the battlefield, but they certainly weren't in the front ranks in the same way that the grown, experienced men were. So that's one fallacy that we... One origin of the fallacy, as far as I'm concerned, it could be a very viable one. The second one you hear a lot of is, but the roofs on their buildings were so tiny, and the ceilings were so low, and the doorways were so low, and I've been to England or Ireland or whatever, and they must have been like tiny people because you have to stoop to walk in. Okay, that's interesting. So if that were the case, why did they build these giant bloody castles, I wonder? Why didn't they just make these castles smaller? If everyone was so small, why didn't they just construct them smaller so that these little people could defend them? It's I don't know. Sometimes the image I conjure up is something along the lines of hobbit-like people or something. Fact of the matter is, they didn't have electricity, they didn't have bar heaters or gas heaters or radiators or anything else like that to keep them warm. They had a fire. The warmth from the fire had to be trapped, it had to be kept in these buildings, and the way they did that was just constrain the space, the space that the heat had to fill. So they'd keep the ceilings a little bit lower. If you look at some of the grand halls and such, they're absolutely gigantic, and it's a reflection on wealth and power and prestige. So it's not because they were tiny little people. So with that digression over and done with, we shall move on to the next story. The next story is the Templars were absolved of heresy. This could be old news to some, but sadly, here in Australia, we receive a lot of magazines up to 4 months after they come out in the rest of the world. And it was in the 2007 December issue of Forty and Times magazine, which reported that Pope Clement V absolved the Templars of heresy in 1308, though he did find them guilty of immorality and had plans to reform the order. Clement later reversed his decision and suppressed the order in 1312 after pressure from King Philippe IV of France. All of this information has recently come to light after the facsimile publication of the Processus Contra Templarios, or the Trial of the Templars, a 300-page leather-bound book detailing the trial. The book contains the parchment of Chinon from the 1308 trial, and it was discovered by Barbara Frail in 2001, and it's a document that details interrogations of the leaders of the Templars while the French king imprisoned them, or had them imprisoned, rather. Imprisoned. I'll say it slowly. If you would like to buy a copy of this limited edition work, complete with replica plastic seal of the inquisitors who conducted the interrogations in 1308, best be quick. There are only 800 copies, with one already gifted to Pope Benedict XVI, leaving 799, and they are sure to sell out fast at the bargain price of €5,900, that is $9,500 Australian dollars, £4,500 Great Britain pounds, or $8,900 US dollars. I myself am going to lay by a copy, or for our American friends, put one on layaway and hope to have it and give you a review sometime in 2020. Sometimes it saddens me that the people who would appreciate these things are mostly among the last people who could ever spare the cash to buy one. Let's hope that a museum somewhere is feeling thrifty enough to purchase a copy and display it for the world to see. Media news, www.lookandlearn.com. From 1962 to 1982, Look and Learn magazine entertained and educated children and adults alike with wonderfully illustrated publications, which included, among other things, a wide array of articles on the Middle Ages. This nostalgic magazine has been reinvented thanks to the World Wide Web in the form of lookandlearn.com, and it contains a history of the magazine along with an archive of articles and illustrations about the Middle Ages. Although the publication was aimed at children, adults found it fun and educating as well, or at least so the website promotes. I've never experienced the magazine outside of the internet form, but it does look as though it would have been really, really cool. Although the publication was aimed at children, adults apparently found it fun and educating as well. And I highly recommend this site for kids interested in history, and I know that parents or adults without children would get a kick out of the site as well. Its illustrators include the late Angus McBride, who's famous for his historical paintings as seen in many books, including the Osprey series of historical books, and Gary Embleton, another famous author-artist of the historical genre. There's a whole bunch of other well-known illustrators and authors as well, so head on over to www.lookandlearn.com to check them out, and you won't be disappointed. Just as a side note, some of the illustrations, for the people who may not be as knowledgeable on authenticity as other listeners, some of the illustrations are not 100% accurate, but they invoke a great feel, and they're just a whole lot of fun. I haven't had a look at the article, so I can't comment on them. But as always, don't take any one illustration or one source as gospel. If you find something interesting, do a little bit of research and see what you come up with, and consistency will prove, I guess, or consistency will reveal what appears to be the most common truth in these matters. So head over and check them out. In semi-related medieval news, I'd like to give a shout out to a good friend of mine and give his website a plug as well. Adam Phillips is an artist and animator with a resume as long as your arm. His website, although not entirely medievally, certainly has a medieval-ish fantasy influence in some of his works. Well, to be honest, there's more modern comedy and high fantasy, and I'm just giving a mate a free plug on the show, but check it out anyway. You'll love the art, the cartoons, and scary stories. www.bitycastle.com is the address, and if you want a comical medieval fix, check out his short entitled, his short animation. He calls these animations shorts. It's entitled Marauder, and yeah, you'll get a bit of a giggle out of that. Any of his Brackenwood features are also a lot of fun to watch. And for you Dungeons & Dragons fans, his animations for Wizards of the Coast, including the latest one about the succubus and the gnome, pretty fun to watch as well. Really funny stuff. And if you decide to say hi to Adam or buy one of his t-shirts, tell him that Sir Justin the Big sent ya. Wikipedia, the free online encyclopedia, has reportedly offended 180,000 Muslims by publishing medieval images of the Prophet Muhammad and have refused to remove them from their European language-based sites, despite complaints from followers of Islam who claim to be offended by the images. The Persian and Ottoman images from the 14th, 15th and 16th century are offensive to Islam, which prohibits any representation of Muhammad, except, obviously, in the 14th, 15th and 16th centuries. Some protesters claim that the images have been displayed to openly bait and insult Muslims, and Wikipedia spokespeople have suggested that if you are offended by the images, don't visit the site. In an official statement, Wikipedia editors said, "Wikipedia recognizes that there are cultural traditions among some Muslim groups that prohibit depictions of Muhammad and other prophets, and that some Muslims are offended when those traditions are violated. However, the prohibitions are not universal among Muslim communities, particularly with the Shia, who, while prohibiting the images, are less strict about it. Since Wikipedia is an encyclopedia with the goal of representing all topics from a neutral point of view, Wikipedia is not censored for the benefit of any particular group. So long as they're relevant to the article and do not violate any of Wikipedia's existing policies, nor the law of the US state of Florida, where Wikipedia servers are hosted, no content or images will be removed because people find them objectionable or offensive." And while I may offend people by saying this, I'd like to commend Wikipedia on their conviction and their tenacity in the face of public outcry in regards to this whole situation. My opinion is that you can't censor history without altering the truth, and that people who are offended should respect such items rich in heritage and culture. Think about how much has been lost to us because of war, religion and prejudice, and it would be really nice just to see people put a lid on it. And finally in the news, an interpretation of Macbeth starring Patrick Stewart is being performed at the Brooklyn Academy of Music through to March 22, 2008. Patrick Stewart, who is most famous for his role as Captain Picard from Star Trek The Next Generation, has been in several medieval genre movies such as The Lion in Winter, Lady Jane, Excalibur and Robin Hood Men in Tights. But this performance, sadly, is not set in medieval Scotland. It is instead set in Stalin's Russia. Sorry to get your hopes up there. I too had thought it was going to be closer to the original format, but was disappointed to find it was yet another modern rendition of one of Shakespeare's plays. And, well, misery loves company, so I just had to get your hopes up there and just dash them down. For those really looking forward to a new medieval movie, The Other Boleyn Girl opened on February 29th in cinemas worldwide and is a movie based on the novel by Philippa Gregory, and it stars Natalie Portman and Scarlett Johansson as the Boleyn sisters, and Eric Bana as Henry VIII. From what I understand, it is an enjoyable movie and true to the time period and the people it depicts. That is the news for March 2008 on the All Things Medieval podcast. Come one, come all, lords and ladies, fellow countrymen and women, gather round and hear all about exciting events, fairs and tournaments coming soon to our fair lands. Yes, and off we go, charging headlong like an errant knight into the enemy, straight into events. This month, we have an event which is coming up very shortly, the Original Reenactors Market in the United Kingdom, March 14th, 15th and 16th, held at the Sports Connection in Ryton on Dunsmore in Warwickshire, is the longest running reenactors market in the UK. For more information, see their website, www.reenactorsmarket.co.uk. This information was sent to me by Gwen at Historic Enterprises, who will be in attendance at the market, so head along if you're in that area and check out the range of fabulous goods they have available. I've heard a lot about the reenactors markets in the UK from friends who have been there or have stalls there, and from what I hear, they're great events. If anyone has a report or review of the event they would like to submit, please do contact us here at the podcast@sirjustin.com. And if you do happen to run into Gwen or Jeff from Historic Enterprises, say hi for me. And you may even run into Luke Binks, who was featured in an interview in last month's episode. You may even see him over there with Jeff and Gwen as well. So say hi to the guys for me and head along and pick up some great gear. The Crusades Easter Gathering, we'll give a shout out to that again. For more information, go to www.danelaw.org.au. That's held over the Easter weekend. Now, I haven't actually received any further news about this event. Now, I have tried to contact the organisers via the website, but I haven't received anything back. That could be an issue on my end. I know I've been having some problems with emails which are just sort of going wayward, and then they turn up weeks, sometimes months later, if at all. That's using one of my other addresses, so don't fear if you're sending to the podcast one. So if you are after more information on that, you may have to do a little bit of digging about on your own. Sorry about that, but that's all I can offer at this stage. Also on during the same weekend, as we stated in the last couple of podcasts, is the Armidale Dark Age Gathering. Again, this is more of a reenactor event rather than open for the public event, but it's a really cool event. I think every reenactor or anyone who has a hands-on interest in the Dark Ages, that is the period they cover, I think, is from about the 4th century up until about the 10th century, something like that. I could be a little bit wrong on that. But you've got to check it out. You've got to go and you've got to have the Armidale experience, at least if you want to call yourself an Australian reenactor, you do. So get along, have a look at it. History Alive at Fort Lytton, Brisbane, Australia on June 7th and 8th with living history displays covering 2,000 years of history. For more information, go to www.historyalive.org.au. And if you would like any further information on that event, you may think I'm covering it a little bit lightly here, head back to the last couple of podcasts, especially podcast number 2. There's a lot of information about the last 2 events that I've mentioned, so go and check that out. And once more, the Abbey Medieval Festival is on in Caboolture from the 5th to the 13th of July. Now, this is in conjunction with the Abbey Museum of Art and Archaeology in St. Michael's Abbey Church, the one which I mentioned right at the beginning of the podcast with the 11th century stained glass windows, and there's some other stained glass there from later periods. It's a week-long event culminating in a 2-day fair and tournament. As I mentioned, it's in Caboolture, Queensland, 30 minutes from the central business district of Brisbane. So head along to www.abbeytournament.com for more details, including details about their banquet and mask ball. It's the premier medieval tournament event in the Southern Hemisphere, and I'd recommend that if you are in the area to check it out. And if you're from overseas, it'll give you an opportunity to really see a showcase of Australian reenactors and living history groups, and maybe make some contacts, and you know, and if you're a merchant or something like that, or or if you have some sort of interest, I'm sure you'll get something out of coming along to it, whether you're from overseas or whether you're travelling from Australia or whether you've been there for the 19th, 20th time or whatever it is they're up to there. I am starting to sound a little repetitive on the events section of the show, so if you have something you'd like to share with us all, contact me with the details at podcast@sirjustin.com or get on the forums at sirjustin.com and get the word out there about your event, whether you're the organizer or whether it's your favorite event to attend. It doesn't matter. Let's just get the word out there and let's go and see some medieval events. And now it's time for the All Things Medieval podcast main feature. Listen to discourse and interviews where we talk about a featured topic or chat with a special guest. This month on the All Things Medieval podcast, we look at one of the most iconic symbols of the Middle Ages and the fallacies that commonly surround it. We're talking about the sword. Of course, some listeners may already know a lot about swords and likely more technical or historical aspects than I do. Consider this feature a beginner's practical guide to history, function, design, and buying a sword in the modern marketplace. I did mention that on this particular episode we'd have an interview with the Hochmeister from the Marxbruder Historical Fight School, Mr. Matthew Hoffman, but he's been fairly busy as of late, and so far the time which I had scheduled with him has gone by the wayside, and we'll catch up with him a bit later. We'll definitely still do the interview and we'll put it on a future episode of the podcast. To make up for that space, I've just extended this feature and we'll talk a little bit more in depth about swords. Stuart Oakeshott quotes something he once wrote in his introduction to his book Records of the Medieval Sword. It goes, "Of all the weapons devised by man in the long lapse of centuries, the sword is the only one which combines effectiveness in defence with force in attack, and since its Bronze Age beginnings has gathered round itself a potent mystique which sets it above any other man-made object." Mr. Oakeshott sums it up far more eloquently than I can, and pretty much hits the nail on the head with that statement. Swords are still fascinating to most of us today. For as long as man has had a military history, the sword has been with us. It's commonly accepted that the sword originated in the Bronze Age, that is, 3500 to 1100 BC, and it progressed into the Iron Age and the Dark Age, and then finally into our area of interest, the Middle Ages. Throughout this time span, the ownership of a sword was always the prestigious mark of a warrior. Swords, since their inception, have remained a symbol of status, power, justice, war, and myth. Who hasn't heard, for example, of Excalibur? Speaking of other myths, there's other commonly lesser-known swords of legend, such as the swords of classical mythology, that is, the Roman and Greek mythology, of Old Norse sagas and mythology, and a couple off the top of my head are Tyrfing, Danesleif, and Gram, just to name a few. There's Beowulf's swords, Hrunting and Nagling, Roland's sword Durendal, Charlemagne's Joyeuse, I think that's how it's pronounced, and that's just to name a few. It's also of interest to note that the Bible has mention of the sword 427 times, one of which quotes Jesus as saying in Luke 22:36, "And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one." Biblically, swords are seen as weapons of justice, defence, and righteousness when used with good intent, and weapons of death, destruction, and murder in the hands of the evil. The allure of the sword continues today with the swords of modern fiction, including the swords of Tolkien's Middle-earth, Glamdring, Orcrist, Sting, and Anduril. Others I can mention are the Singing Sword, the Sword of Shannara, Stormbringer, Green Destiny, and, dare I even say, lightsabers. The list could go on and on, but the point is that we're fascinated with the sword. However, because of these myths, both ancient and modern, and the fact that the sword has become more of a novel antique in the eyes of so many, we have lost a lot of practical knowledge about real swords. We'll address some of these myths very soon. So what typified a sword of the Middle Ages? First and foremost is the development of a cross on the hilt, also called quillions. These developed in the 11th century into the shape we call a cruciform shape, which stayed in common use for the whole Middle Ages. The sword of this age was a single-handed sword, today often termed as an arming sword. It was used in combination with a shield and was generally around 1 metre in length. At this stage, the sword was no longer so much a cut-and-thrust weapon like the short swords of the Bronze and Early Iron Age, but more of a cutting weapon used to cut the flesh, break bones, and sometimes sever limbs, in the same way as the Norse and Saxon swords. We then see the sword start to develop a thrusting point in the later Middle Ages and a lengthening of the grip into eventually the war swords or bastard swords, the long swords, and the great swords of the 14th century onwards. The reason for this evolution was to match and overcome the changes that armour underwent. Plate began to supplement and eventually replace mail, so a sword that could both thrust into openings and also strike with force enough to knock a man off his feet became commonplace. Of course, single-handed swords were still in use, but they were now more of a sidearm than a primary weapon for all but archers and light infantry. The sword consists fundamentally of two parts, the blade and the hilt. The blade was used for striking, cutting and thrusting, and commonly was double-edged. The blade also may have a fuller or could be a diamond section blade, and some had a ricasso, a thick part of the blade close to the hilt left unsharpened and used for binds and strong parries that could be turned into counter-strikes while preserving the edge. The hilt consisted of the cross, the grip and the pommel, and also an extension of the blade beneath the grip called the tang. The tang is the part of the blade which keeps the hilt and pommel firmly affixed to the blade by painting the end of the tang over the pommel, which passes through the centre and thus affixing it to the blade. Something that I will not speak on in this episode are the details of forging a sword in the Middle Ages. That in and of itself could be a whole feature on its own and one that I'd need to call an expert in for, as it's beyond my knowledge to do it justice. Instead, I will direct you to the Armour website once again, specifically to www.thearmour.org/essays/how-were-swords-made.htm. I'll put a link for that in the schnotes. And they have there on that page a detailed article on the topic of how swords were made in the Middle Ages. Armour, by the way, is the Association of Renaissance Martial Arts and has heaps of great articles and resources. Common untruths about the sword today. There's a lot of them. I hear a lot of them doing my performances and speaking with the public, and I'm going to share just some of the more popular ones that I do hear. So the first one, the most common one that I hear, is swords are heavy, right? Well, wrong. Swords are often thought of as large and heavy, with some people estimating them to be crazy weights, such as 10 or 20 kilograms, which is 20 to 40 pounds, sometimes more. We have factual evidence in the form of surviving swords and archaeological finds from many time periods that they weighed significantly less. Swords weighing even as much as 2.5 kilograms, or around 6 pounds, were horribly heavy and never would have been used in battle. If a sword did weigh that much, historically speaking, it was almost always used for ceremonial purposes. Most real medieval European swords weighed between 2 and 4 pounds regardless of, and this included the two big-handed swords which generally weighed no more than 4 to 5 pounds. Swords were a functional, well-balanced, finely crafted weapon, a tool, if you will, for a master whose canvas was the field of battle. A sword had to be well-balanced and weighted to serve its function to slay and incapacitate with utmost efficiency, or it would serve to hinder its wielder, causing them to perform their job with poor skill, usually resulting in defeat or death. That's some pretty high stakes. A heavy, unbalanced sword leads to fatigue and poor function, which makes it totally useless. The next most common untruth that I probably hear about swords while speaking with the public is blood grooves. This is one of the strangest concepts, yet I hear it so often that it baffles me. We've determined that a fuller was present on the swords. Some people call the fuller a blood groove or a blood gutter and claim that they were used for things like letting blood run cleanly from the wound, to stop a suction effect on the blade and thus stopping a sword from being stuck in the body, to let air into the wound, and other nonsense. Pure and simple, a fuller was present on a blade for two reasons. One, to lessen the weight to perfect the balance of the blade, and two, to give the blade added strength and flexibility. Swords don't get stuck in the body or trapped by suction no matter what any movie, comic, game or book tells you, and blood does not neatly cascade down the gutter or groove to aid in it flowing more freely from the wound or again to avoid being trapped in the body. So we'll have no more of that nonsense, thanks. The next one I hear a lot of is the samurai's katana versus a knight's sword. Quite often you stumble across the internet a lot of the times, different forums where these sort of debates are raging, and people are arguing which sword was better. So whose sword was better? Sort of like saying, was King Arthur's sword better than Christopher Lambert's? Let me put this argument into context. They're asking, or rather what they should be asking fundamentally, is was the European sword more adept at doing its job and serving its function against those who it was used against, or was the samurai's katana more functional against the people it was used against? What an odd question. If a knight battled a samurai, whose sword was superior? Well, I've got an opinion on this. The sword whose hand wielded it with more skill and more experience. I do wish to make it clear, however, that a samurai sword cannot cut through steel like butter, or through 10 men, nor through concrete supports as seen in the Highlander movie. And just for the record, neither can a knight's. Let's all remember that most movies are fiction, and that fiction is fiction as well. www.thearmor.org/essays/knights-versus has a more in-depth article on this subject. Of interest is the story of famed Japanese author Yukio Mishima, who in 1970 committed public ritual suicide after an unsuccessful attempt to incite the armed forces to stage a coup d'etat. Mishima committed ritual suicide in the office of General Kentoshi Mashita. His second, who was tasked with the beheading part of the ritual, tried 3 times to behead Mishima with a katana but failed. His head was finally severed by another more skilled swordsman, showing that it was less the sword and more the swordsman who determines the superiority of a blade. Another one that I hear is in regards to the pommel. The pommel of a sword is often thought of as a stopper to ensure the hand doesn't fly off the grip. This is a myth, and anyone who's ever handled a sword can testify to this. The pommel is simply there only to act as a counterbalance to the blade, making it easier to wield and function. It can be used for some techniques, including striking and disarming or parrying, but mostly it's used for the aforementioned purpose. It comes in various shapes, sizes and weights, most commonly in a disc shape. Finally, one of the other things that I hear a lot of is in regards to parries. People often say, wouldn't the sword blade become damaged from parrying all the time, from the sword hitting edge to edge? Well, yes, it would. And that's exactly why they didn't really use a parry like that unless they absolutely had to. Instead, what they would do with a subtle turn of the wrist, they'd present the flat of the blade. If you have a look at any sword in museum collections or private collections that has actually seen use in battle, you'll see scores and scores of scores along the flat of the blade. This shows where the flat of the blade was actually presented during battle or tournament or even training, so that it preserved the edge of the sword a lot better. Some people argue that if you strike edge to edge with a sword, that the edge becomes somewhat work-hardened or similar to hammer-hardened, where the steel becomes more resilient to damage. And that actually would happen, but what we need to realise when people conclude this, it's generally with blunted down swords used for reenactment or theatrical combat. Now, a real sword actually had an edge on it, not unlike the sharpness of a kitchen carving knife, possibly not quite as sharp, but it was still sharp enough that if you took it and hit it edge to edge, huge chips would fly out of the blade. We actually see this as well in the historical surviving examples, where obviously in the heat of battle you're not going to bother yourself too much if you've hit edge to edge and caused a bit of a dent in your sword. I mean, it's a matter of life and death out on the battlefield, so it's not really a concern. Something else we need to keep in mind in regards to that is that the sword, when we buy a sword today, we buy one and we use one and we hope to have it for many, many years. Back in the day and age when swords were commonplace on the battlefield, swords were tools. They were weapons which were, they had a use-by date. They were more or less a throwaway weapon. Now, obviously, I would imagine, and it looks as though history does show us that people actually held on to these weapons and passed them down through the ages, especially the fittings and the more resilient parts of the sword, such as the pommel and the cross. But generally, a sword it would serve its purpose for as long as it could, and then you'd discard it or you'd retire it and you'd get a new sword. You wouldn't want to go into battle with a sword which was banged up so much that it could break at any inopportune moment and leave you at a disadvantage and possibly lead you to being seriously injured or killed. It's very similar to saying that modern soldiers today get one rifle and they look after that rifle for their entire career. Now, obviously, they'll look after the weapon, they'll try to preserve it for as long as they can, but if they do need to use it inappropriately or in a way which would damage it to save their lives or the lives of their comrades, then most certainly they do it and replace it later on. So they were disposable weapons. They weren't weapons which were held onto for years and years throughout the career of a knight or of a foot soldier or something like that. That pretty much concludes this episode's feature, and as always, I welcome feedback. Email it to podcast@sirjustin.com or post it on the forums over at sirjustin.com. If you have questions also, I'd love to hear them and answer them for you. And if you have something you'd like to add to this feature or like to clarify, correct or elaborate on anything I've talked about, do get in touch with me.
Let us venture forth, lords and ladies, into the busy marketplace. Wares of all kinds you will find here. Stick close, and I'll keep the cut purses and charlatans off your backs. I know of a merchant house just over here, where we can relax and take our time considering today's goods and services. Ah, here we are now. Let's go inside and lose this crowd, shall we?
Keeping with this episode's theme, we'll look at some swordsmiths, sword sellers, and how to purchase the right sword for you. First of all, when looking for a sword, you need to know exactly what it is you want it for. Is it a wall hanger, or will it be used in theatre, or reenactment, martial arts, or play? Are you after something really authentic, or just after something that looks cool? If you just want a sword to display or collect, then you really don't need to be all that discerning, unless you want a historical collection. Even then, if your historical collection is for looks rather than for function, you really only need to purchase based on design. But what about if you want an authentic sword that is functional, historically speaking? Here are some steps to follow. Research. Find the sword you want by reading, checking out museum collections, and looking at websites that are based on research and authenticity rather than commercial sites trying to sell something. Too often you see a website offering the sword of the Black Prince, for example, which is nothing like the real thing and a complete fictional piece as envisioned by its creator. These sort of swords are often mass-produced and made from cast pieces and stainless steel. They're usually some crazy weight, such as 3-4 kilos or more, and if they were used in any form of combat, they'd break very quickly. Fantasy swords, usually more often than not, fall into this category as well. Next thing you need to do is ensure the sword that you've got your eye on is made of spring steel. The best way to test this is to bend the blade and see if it returns to a straightened position. Obviously, you can't walk into a shop or vendor and start bending his swords willy-nilly, potentially ruining his stock or her stock. A sword that is made of spring steel or is properly hand-forged will give with very little pressure. A sword that is not will be very resistant to bending, so you need only to apply very slight pressure when testing this principle. Something else you need to look for is the sword a full tang piece? This means the pommel should have a tang paned over the end of it. It will look like a steel hand-forged rivet that appears to hold the pommel on. A lot of swords that are not functional will have a smooth pommel without a hole or tang visible at its end. These are most likely threaded tangs where a bolt is welded onto the end of the blade and a nut secures the hilt and the pommel may screw on over the top. These swords usually break at the tang if they are used, or the hilt and the cross become loose, or the pommel even unthreads itself. All of this, of course, can be confusing for the novice collector who wants an authentic sword. I'll try to post some pics on the blog or the forums, but failing that, your best bet is to check out these websites that you can trust to be manufacturers or distributors of high-quality, high-fidelity reproductions. The first one is Deltin Army Antiche, which is one I've mentioned in a previous podcast. All swords on the site are based on historical pieces with correct weights and correct dimensions. Their website is www.deltin.it. Albion swords are easily, in my opinion, at the top of historical replicas. It may not be great business for me, considering that I'm the Australian distributor of Deltin swords, but I believe, and so do many others, that Albion swords are the best and closest to the real thing you can get. Sounds like a dumb thing for me to say, but I have to be honest here. If you have to choose between a Deltin or an Albion, go for the Albion. Sorry, Fulvio, if you're listening, I hope to still be the Deltin man in Australia after this episode. But anyway, if you want to have a look at the Albion swords, check them out at www.albionswords.com. Swords done by Paul Chen are reliable, functional, and pretty much historically accurate. His practical range of swords are a great entry-level sword for those looking to get into swordplay or reenactment, and available exclusively through CAS Iberia. There's a pretty big range there, and they run the whole range from swords which you can use in reenactment and theatrical combat, right up to sharpened collector's pieces, which are display pieces only, including, I might add, a nice reproduction of the Edward III sword, the sword commonly known as the Order of the Garter sword, including a reproduction scabbard as well, complete with the fittings and the coat of arms of Edward III from the 14th century. Another company is called Arms and Armour, and they sell some really great stuff. Their range of weapons are all historically speaking on the money, and you can check them out at www.armour.com. Keep in mind that the word armour is the North American spelling of armour, that is armour.com. For a good selection of swords that are historically accurate, Museum Replicas at www.museumreplicas.com have a good range to choose from. The movie swords, however, are not all entirely historically accurate in design, if not function, but they're still really nice swords, and they are functional swords, but as I said, they're more so created, or they're replicas of the movie pieces, and generally movie pieces are designed as a feature weapon with the movie in mind, and with it has to be visually appealing more so than historically accurate. But that said, even their movie swords are functional swords. For custom-made swords, you really need to look around for reliable swordsmiths. One I can recommend is Luke Binks, whom I interviewed on the last show, but Luke has moved over to California, and his schedule may be filled for quite a while. If you are interested in contacting Luke, however, to find out for yourself, his email is luke_binks@hotmail.com. Another custom swordsmith that accepts commissions is Alex Scheib. I can never pronounce your name, Alex. I'm very sorry, my friend. Alex Scheibner, or Scheiber. He's gonna get upset with me about this. Oh, maybe not. His company is called Talon Forge, and Alex has also done a lot of movie work, including the swords for the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. Contact Alex and check out his work at www.friol.com/members/talon/index.htm. I'll put that in the schnotes so you don't have to get a headache trying to remember it, and I think I may have mispronounced the word Friol, I'm not too sure, but if someone could let me know, that would be great. It's spelled Forjel. If you are a custom swordsmith with an inclination for historical pieces and want to get the word out, contact me at podcast@sirjustin.com. I'd love to do my part to market your talents. Alternatively, and it might even be better for you, head on over to the forums at www.sirjustin.com and post your details there for the world to see. Finally, a website that's a great resource for the first-time sword buyer is www.swordbuyersguide.com. I would recommend checking that out if you're a novice, if you've never really got into it before, but you'd like to buy a sword as a collector's piece, or even if you're getting into reenactment, or you want something which you can use in Western martial arts. Read this guide, get online, have a look at it. It's really informative, and it's pretty accurate, it's pretty spot on. I haven't had a chance to read it word for word, but what I have read of it is very informative, and it's very practical. And And so we near the end of yet another episode of the All Things Medieval podcast. But before we do go, I've had a bit of feedback from listeners this last month, mostly quick, concise comments saying how they've enjoyed the show. And I'd like to say thanks to you all. I had one email in particular from Scott in St. Augustine, Florida, in the United States, which had some great comments regarding the show. Scott asked, "What was happening in the rest of the world during this time? Your description of the Middle Ages was great in describing the years and major events involved, but it wasn't clear about geography. You mentioned Italy and the Crusades, but your description seemed to be focused on Western Europe and England. You didn't directly state this, but I think it was implied." Well, Scott, you picked it fairly well, and I should explain myself. Most of my knowledge, aside from being 14th century, is also mostly English and French. Because I focus on that period and culture, it comes out in the show more than any other culture, society, or time period. I'm already making an attempt to head into other periods and cultures, and hopefully it will become more apparent as I go along. Thanks for asking. Scott's also looking for someone who produces conquistador armor of high fidelity for use in festivals in his hometown. So if you are someone who makes it or know of someone who does, drop me a line and I'll forward it on to Scott. Or alternatively, drop it into the forums under the marketplace for everyone to see. Scott also had a request for a feature, or something along the lines of a feature, on courtly love. I'm already planning something regarding this, as I too feel that it's often poorly neglected, so keep an ear out for that in the future. Well, that's about it for this episode. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show enough that you'll be back for the next one. Next month, I hope to be talking to Cliff Turpin, Australia's resident longbow expert, and we'll have some interesting discourse regarding the famed longbow. I hope you can join us for that. Until then, a pluta! You can contact All Things Medieval Podcast with your praise, criticism, suggestions, questions, and other feedback at podcast@sirjustin.com. Join in the forums over at sirjustin.com by clicking on the forums tab in the menu on the left-hand side. Thanks to Kevin McLeod at incomtech.com for permission to use his track Folkground. This has been the All Things Medieval Podcast for March 2008. Blood grooves, eh? Oh, blood grooves. Samurai swords, blood grooves. Can almost picture these midgets with their 20-kilogram swords riding their massive horses, living in their tiny homes and defending these giant castles. dear me. Oh, it's still recording. Bugger.